Abby Mountain.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, August 29th, 2025. I'm Breanne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. In 2022, the long-tailed macaque was classed as an endangered species by the IUCN. This week on Rabble Radio, Rabble editor Nick Seabrook sits down with Dr. Lisa Jones-Engel to discuss the plight of the long-tailed macaque, how this intelligent species landed on the endangered list, and why the continued use of primates in animal testing is not only outdated, but ethically indefensible. They also discuss what you can do to help end the importation of endangered monkeys from Cambodia. Here are Dr. Lisa Jones-Engel and Nick Seabrook. Take a listen.
All right, so I guess to get started, could you tell me about the issue that we're talking about today of monkeys coming from Cambodia into Canada for animal testing?
And you've kind of summed it up right there. Canada has emerged as kind of a focal point in the international trade in primates for experimentation. When one of the biggest movers and shakers of monkeys in the world, Charles River Laboratories, had its ability to bring monkeys from Cambodia into the U.S. halted in early 2023, the CEO of Charles River actually made an announcement that they were looking for friendlier governments to open the doors to them to facilitate the importation of monkeys. And it turns out that Canada was apparently that one of those friendlier governments, because we saw an astonishing pivot of Cambodian origin monkeys going into Canada when other countries were not accepting them.
These monkeys, what sort of monkeys are we talking about? What sort of breed? And what is the issue around them being imported into Canada?
You just asked, you're talking to a primatologist, so I can talk about monkeys all day. But the reason I do want to talk just a little bit about it is because, you know, when most people think about primates, they think about the gorillas, the chimpanzees, the orangutan, these big, boldly colored apes. No one really thinks about the monkeys. And this monkey in particular has been ignored by the media and by people for too long. So these are called the long-tailed macaques. Their scientific name is Macaca fascicularis. The industry calls them the cynomolgus monkey. They're the perfect monkey. They're not too big. They're not too small. They're about the size of a really big house cat. They have a long, beautiful tail, which they use to navigate as they're moving through the canopy or they're running across the rooftops in villages. Their hands are nimble. They're great for holding on to each other, for a mother holding on to her infant. They live in large social groups, multi-male, multi-female. A troop can be anywhere from 30 to 60 or 70 animals in total. They predominantly live in Southeast Asia. There was a population, actually it was a pair that made their way to Mauritius, an island off the coast of Africa, about 400 years ago. So Mauritius also has a large population of them. They are omnivorous, predominantly fruit eaters, but they will eat whatever they can. And one of the exquisite qualities of these monkeys is that they can read us, humans, in a way that almost no other animal can. So they live close to us. They're called an edge species, where we open up edges, whether it's on the edge of a farm field or a road leading into a city or the edge of your property. These monkeys are really good exploiting the niches that we create as humans. We've had relationships with them for 25,000 years. You know, their bones show up in the Nea Caves in Borneo. And they're amongst the genus of the primate that is most widely distributed around the world. So you've got Homo sapiens, you've got us who cover everywhere. And then you have this genus Macaca that goes all the way from, you know, the top of the mountains in Tibet to Japan, to the Philippines, throughout Southeast Asia, over into all the way up to Bangladesh and then up into Afghanistan. It's an extraordinarily adaptable species. And that has been its downfall because the pharmaceutical industry decided about 30 years ago, no one's paying attention to this monkey. They seem to be everywhere. We're going to use them for experimentation. And that's when they started being brought by the tens of thousands into predominantly U.S. laboratories for use in toxicology studies.
In terms of where in Cambodia these monkeys are being sourced from, are these being sourced from, are these monkeys domesticated, being sourced from, say, farms, or are they being sourced from other places?
They're certainly not all being sourced from farms, but you just brought up a really good point. Any scientist, keep in mind, I spent 30 years as a biomedical scientist. Any scientist worth their salt knows you never use anything but a purpose-bred, captive-bred primate for your experiments. That's because you want to know the health history. You want to know the veterinary history. And maybe you even want to make sure that you're not, you know, contributing to the decline of another species of primate by having them extracted from the wild. But all that really fell apart at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, when the industry basically said, we need monkeys. And that meant China actually closed their border to monkey exports at that time. And Southeast Asia, particularly Cambodia, said, hey, you want monkeys? You're paying $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a head for monkeys? We'll give you monkeys. At which case, it was an absolute free-for-all. The evidence, I mean, we've had trials in the U.S., the CITES, the global kind of authority on trade, the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, also a global authority on the status and preservation of plants and animals, all came out and said, whoa, we have lots of wild monkeys that are being rounded up and dropped into these quote, monkey farms in Cambodia and Vietnam and elsewhere. And they are being falsely labeled as captive bred and then being sent abroad for use in experimentation. There was a trial in the U.S. back in 2024 following an indictment of multiple Cambodians about the illegal monkey laundering. In that trial, evidence was presented that showed that during a five-year period from like 2017 to 2022, an estimated 30,000 wild-caught monkeys from one farm in Cambodia were funneled into the U.S. pipeline for experimentation. 30,000 wild-caught, and that's a fraction of the total number. So to answer your question, no, these animals, there is absolutely no way to guarantee that the monkey that shows up in that crate at the airport or then shows up in your cage, in your quarantine facility, or on your table in your laboratory is a captive bred animal. That guarantee does not exist.
Now, in terms of the health of the species of this monkey, of the long-tailed macaque, are they facing any sort of endangerment in the wild or in captivity or anything like that?
Exactly. In 2022, a group of 17 or 18 scientists actually submitted an assessment of the long-tailed macaque to the IUCN, International Union for the Conservation of Nature. That assessment was done by field primatologists on the ground, scientists such as myself, other scientists who have studied long-tailed macaques in the wild. And we showed that the population decline was astonishing. Subsequent publications showed like an 80% decline in the number of primates of long-tailed macaques prior to just a few decades ago, with an ongoing threat of an even greater, of a 50% reduction of the animals that were less. The IUCN announced in 2022, they elevated these monkeys to the endangered status. Additional reports were put out by scientists, and boy, was there blowback from the pharmaceutical industry. And in fact, they said these scientists must have been biased. These data are garbage. Look, there are plenty of these monkeys everywhere. This is just being driven by an animal rights narrative. I am happy to report that just today, truly just today, the IUCN just published on their website that the assertion that this assessment was driven by conflict of interest, or the information should be dismissed because of a conflict of interest, IUCN came back and said, no, there's no indication that there was a conflict of interest. We're expecting in early October another assessment of the long-tailed macaques from the IUCN, because the industry pushed so hard to get them to back down and say, no, these monkeys are fine. There's no cause for alarm. There is cause for alarm. You walk into the forests of Southeast Asia now, and you don't see monkeys. You do not see long-tailed macaques.
And that decline in population, that led to it becoming an endangered species. Is that solely because of its desirability as a test subject for the pharmaceutical industry, or are there other factors like habitat loss, climate change, hunting?
Absolutely. Habitat conversion. Hunting is not really so big in Southeast Asia for these animals. They are often captured for the pet trade, though. An infant macaque is a really appealing thing. But think about it. The value of these monkeys soared so that the amount of money that a trapper, any random villager could get by going out and trapping a monkey was that's hard to say no to. If you're a villager trying to put food on your plate, if you're trying to get, clothes for your child to go to school, and you've got folks coming out saying, "Bring us your monkeys, we will give you a lot of money." And these monkeys were, again, being taken for the pharmaceutical, for the primary biomedical industry. So, no, I can't solely point to the pharmaceutical industry and say you are the main driver, or you're the only driver, but I can say you are driving a really big truck full of monkeys out of those forests. You are in the driver's seat.
Now, in terms of what those monkeys are used for, you mentioned the pharmaceutical industry. What sort of experimentation are they primarily used for? I mean, often you hear of mice as being used for as test subjects, especially in the pharmaceutical industry. What sort of tests are these monkeys better suited for to be used on?
So in pharmaceutical and biopharma, the macaque has long been basically a safety filter. Before, an experimental compound will be injected into a macaque and they'll look to see whether that there's liver toxicity or kidney toxicity or whether there's a massive immunogenic response to this experimental compound. Up until December of 2022, that was required by law here in the USDA. The FDA, our Food and Drug Administration, required that before any drug went into the arm or the mouth or of a human, it had to pass through a primate, a non-human primate, or another large mammal. Sometimes they would use pigs, sometimes dogs, but the monkey, the long-tailed macaque, has for decades been that guinea pig, for lack of better words. That changed in December of 2022. The FDA Modernization Act was passed. The FDA has come out and said, we will accept other testing modalities. And what we've seen in the past 3 years, Nick, is the absolute explosion of non-animal methods for screening new drugs that will eventually go on to human clinical trials. And why that is because the industry, everyone has known, again, for decades, that what works in a mouse or a monkey, what is safe in a mouse or a monkey, 90 to 95% of the time, it's not effective or safe in humans. We've always known that. And this explosion of these non-animal methods, and these are the, you've heard about them, the organs on the chip, the 3D printed tissues, the use of AI to basically assess the components of a compound, of an experimental compound, and look at historical data and say, well, you know what? That molecule does tend to trigger liver toxicity. So that's probably not going to work. It has been a brilliant upsurge of scientists using good science to bring about improvements in humans' health, not using monkeys.
Now, this next question for our listeners, who obviously I assume many of them are animal lovers, may be difficult to hear because I'd like to ask what the conditions are like for these monkeys, like after they are captured, transported to wherever they're going to go, what sort of conditions they live in these laboratories, and what their life is like.
The horror does not begin in the lab. The lab is actually the last spot. Where it really begins is in the forests and the villages in Asia. The demand was so great that for the first time ever, we saw a practice where entire troops were being targeted and trapped. The hunters would go out into the forest, they'd find the sleeping tree, because this is the thing about macaques. At the end of the day, during the day, the group will split apart, they'll be foraging through large areas, miles and miles, kilometers of home range. But in the evening, everybody comes back to the sleeping tree. And that's for safety, that's for comfort, that's for everyone to hang out together, to groom and whatnot. So the hunters would identify these trees. In the night, they would then go in, cut all the surrounding trees around, put nets down, and then they would start banging. And the macaques could, because the trees are cut down, they couldn't leap to the next tree that was, 5, 10 meters away. So they would start running down. And here's another thing about macaques. Macaques will fight to the death to protect each other. So the first ones coming down are the big adult males. And these are big, angry. They've got, you know, large canines. They are there. They know that their troop is under attack. And they will fight. And they're met with clubs and machetes. And you know, they're dispatched. The females come down next. The females with the infants. Those mothers will do everything in their power to hold on to those infants. And, you know, the footage is out there of literally having those infants ripped off of their bodies, stuffed into to the crates. The animals that survive, now they head to the monkey farms. These animals are beaten. They're injured. They're terrified. They're stressed. There are rampant diseases in the monkey farms, you know, gut pathogens, tuberculosis, measles, hepatitis, malaria. The animals are then at some point boxed up into the crates. The trips to places like Canada can be 36, 48 hours. That's just kind of, that's in the air time. That doesn't include the amount of time that they were loaded up in the farms. And these boxes, you know, they're barely big enough. These are wooden crates, barely big enough for the monkeys to turn around in. 720 of them will be loaded up on an airplane, flown, you know, hopscotching across the planet to land at Mirabel. They're unloaded. They're terrified. They're dehydrated. They're injured at that point. They then go into quarantine. They're in single cages. And again, these are social animals. For a macaque, the most devastating thing that you can do to them is to take away their ability to have contact with another macaque. I mean, it's horrifying. They leave quarantine. Most of them still have diseases. They go into the laboratories. And in about 6 months, after they've gone on study, the study is over. They're killed. They're boxed up in a red biohazard bag, dropped into the incinerator or the, you know, the liquid that dissolves them. And that's it. There is no happy ending. They never go back to the forest. There's no sanctuary. There's no pretty music that's played. From the moment that they enter this primate importation pipeline, this is a death sentence. And it ends in the laboratories in the U.S., in Canada, U.K., the EU, China, everywhere else.
Very disturbing to think of that kind of a fate for another living creature, especially one as intelligent, as you said, as the macaque is. For our listeners, what do you want to see our government do in response to this issue? And for those listening who might want to get involved, what advice would you give them?
What do people need to know? We're in the 21st century. We don't need to be relying upon a monkey trade that is steeped in illegality and cruelty and scientific inefficiency. This is Canada. Canada is doing the dirty work for an American company. Canadian officials have basically green-lighted Charles River to say, bring us your monkeys. They're diseased, whatnot. We don't care. The lack of response from Canadian officials, CFIA, ECC, to address this has been astonishing to us. And so we have been working with multiple groups, Abolition Vivisection, Animal Alliance Canada, certainly PETA has been leading this charge, to get the Canadians aware of what is going on. Because I think Canadians are probably like most Americans. They had no idea that in 2025, we are still pulling monkeys out of the forests of Southeast Asia and dropping them in cages in Canada, in the U.S. We all thought that was over and done with. It's not. And as long as this remains hidden, companies like Charles River will continue to exploit these monkeys. So I think that what your listeners need to do is to, there's a petition out right now to basically stop the importation of primates coming into Canada. You've got, again, PETA. You've got the groups in Canada who are pressuring your Canadian officials, asking ECC, CFIA to, hey, stop this. Stop exposing us to the risks that are associated with this trade. Stop making Canada complicit in an international monkey trade that has no business in the world right now. This is not science. This is monkey business. We all agree that science is important, but using diseased, distressed monkeys pulled from the forests of Asia and Mauritius is not science. That's simply monkey business.
Well said, Dr. Lisa Jones-Engel. Thank you so much for shining a light on this issue.
Absolutely.
That was Rabble editor Nick Seabrook and Dr. Lisa Jones-Engel in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Nick and Lisa. Switching gears now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. To do that, let's turn things back over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with health news. NDP MP Heather McPherson is calling on the federal government to make sure that the COVID-19 vaccine remains accessible to all Canadians. Alberta has announced that it will be reducing the number of available COVID-19 vaccines this year. Additionally, the province will be charging $110 to those who wish to receive the vaccine. COVID-19 is still with us. There have been over 100,000 new COVID-19 cases detected in Canada since last August, and this number only accounts for those with symptoms who were able to be tested. McPherson said that the Alberta government's decision restricts access to healthcare based on economic factors, something that violates the Canada Health Act. In a statement, McPherson writes, quote, "This is not what Canadians expect from our health system. From Tommy Douglas's fight for Medicare to the recent passage of national pharmacare legislation, universal access to healthcare is a cornerstone of what it means to be Canadian." End quote. In other health news this week, Jacqueline Potvin argues on behalf of the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada that access to reproductive care is not only an important health issue, but an economic one as well. Being able to prevent or end pregnancy means people are better able to pursue higher education, fulfill their goals, and potentially become more economically independent. Potvin said that the federal government's decision to cut funding for the Ministry for Women and Gender Equality flies in the face of their commitment to strengthen the economy of Canada for these reasons. Strengthening the economy, Potvin argues, requires a commitment to reproductive health and reproductive justice. Also this week, in an op-ed on Rabble, Charlotte Cheesby and Peter Driftmeyer argue that Reform Judaism is betraying its roots by not standing up in defense of Palestinians. Reform Judaism is a sect of the Jewish faith that was founded in 1818 and directly rejected Zionism. Since then, Reform Judaism has maintained a strong history of progressive values. Practitioners of Reform Judaism have long advocated for the rights of immigrants, people needing abortions, the 2S LGBTQ+ community, and particularly in the United States, against gun violence. However, Cheesby and Driftmeyer argue that since October 7, 2023, many leading members of the Reform Judaism movement have failed to call for an end to the violence and starvation of Palestinian civilians. They call on members of Reform Jewish synagogues who believe that more must be done to end the genocide in Gaza to protest against their institutions who are failing to act, writing, quote, "For grassroots impact, Reform Jews in the United States and Canada have launched a synagogue dues strike to pressure the movement's institutions to break ranks with the broader Jewish institutional ecosystem that condones or obfuscates the Gaza genocide." End quote. In environmental news, earlier this month, negotiations on a treaty that would regulate the proliferation of plastics failed to find a workable agreement. Over 184 nations were party to the negotiations. The treaty would have seen restrictions put in place on the creation of plastics, as well as a requirement to clean up plastic waste littering the earth and oceans. David Suzuki says that the negotiations were sabotaged by oil-producing countries, particularly the United States, Russia, and Saudi Arabia, and by the largest delegation in attendance, which was made up of 234 lobbyists from the fossil fuel and chemical industries, including ExxonMobil, Dow, the American Chemical Council, Coca-Cola, and others. Suzuki explained why the negotiations failed, saying, quote, "Plastic negotiations failed largely because curtailing this industry, protecting the global environment and the life that depends on it, threatens a system designed to give a small minority a disproportionately large share of money and influence." End quote. Also on Rabble this week, Tom Sanborn reviews the recently released book Squat the City: How to Use the Arts for Housing Justice by Norman Narwaki. The book chronicles Naraki's experiences fighting for justice for the unhoused and underhoused in Quebec. Naraki partnered with musician Sylvain Côté to pair art with activism and created the band known as Rhythm Activism. Together, along with a network of housing activists in Quebec City, they created Le Front d'Action Populaire en Reménagement Urbain, a group dedicated to advocating for inclusive, affordable housing. Sanborn said Squat the City can be a handbook for anyone interested in music, activism, and affordable housing. Have you been enjoying learning about these news stories? Are you a young journalist with a passion for progressive storytelling? Well, Rabble is now looking for its next Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow. This four-month-long fellowship supports emerging journalists who are enthusiastic about social justice-forward reporting. Over the course of the fellowship, our Journalism for Change Fellow will work alongside Rabble's editor, me, and receive story assignments, as well as have the opportunity to pursue their own long-form feature story or series. The fellowship pays a stipend of $5,000 for the four-month period, divided in four monthly installments. For more details on how to apply, please visit rabble.ca/journalismforchange. The application deadline is September 22nd at midnight. And finally, for folks in the Toronto area, Rabble is holding a trivia night on Wednesday, September 3rd at the Supermarket Bar at 268 Augusta Avenue in Toronto. This is our first in-person fundraising event for quite some time, and we'd love to see you there. The trivia will test your knowledge of Canadian news, politics, and history, all whilst raising money to strengthen our reporting and uniting our rabble-rousing community. If you're in the area, come down and join the fun. Visit rabble.ca for more details. And as always, you can read all about all the stories we talked about today on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. And thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brienne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.